Well, good morning, everyone. It's good to see everyone here, and as Travis mentioned, especially good to see Mary back with us after a very long absence, and glad that that was able to work out this morning. This morning, I want us to begin by reminding us of a passage that I'm sure many of us, if not all of us, have heard at least a few times in our life, and maybe have heard it a lot and have read it on a regular basis, and that, of course, is Jesus telling us that if anyone would come after me, to take up his own cross and follow after him. And this, of course, gets into the root of what we do when we have trust and faith in someone or something. There comes with that, there's something that follows. It's not just enough to say to our spouse, for example, well, I love you, and then that's the extent of it. There's something that follows that. There is a devotion, a loyalty that comes with that. And when we talk about, of course, with any relationship that we have that particularly has a aspect of authority with it, then obviously that becomes an issue of, well, okay, there are rules, there are laws, there's ordinances, there's certain things that are a part of that relationship. Even on the job, there's rules at work, there's things you're to do. It's a job description, things you don't do. School, same thing. Even family, there are obligations, there are responsibilities. And as one begins to contemplate that and to think about those obligations and responsibilities that come with the relationship that you're talking about, and again, that relationship might be a rather intimate one, like marriage, family, or it might be less so, maybe at work or in some sort of organization that you've joined or you're a part of, or you're affiliated with. But regardless of that, there are those responsibilities and obligations that you think about. As you do so, there becomes that tension that ends up being within your mind and within your gut even about, why am I really doing this? Is it really based on some sort of relationship, or is it just an obligation that I've found myself in? And then you end up thinking, well, I'm kind of stuck with this, and I'm going to do this, but it's just because I have to. And, well, I don't want to lose my job, or, well, I don't want to lose my family, or I don't want to get in trouble, I don't want to get arrested, and it ends up being the idea of fulfilling those obligations, obeying the commandments or the laws or the rules or whatever. It's a matter of obedience, but it's almost a forced obedience. It's almost something that, well, I have a sense of obligation, but I don't really like it, and so I'm going to do these things, but it's only so I don't, or so I can avoid consequences, so I can avoid maybe losing something that I, there's a benefit that I want or that I have, and I don't want to lose the benefit, so I do it. But, deep down inside, I really wish there was another way. I wish I could maybe, and of course, what do we do? Well, you know, the proverbial pursuit of loopholes, right? Well, maybe I can get by and still maintain the benefit, but I can skip a couple things and do it this way. And, well, then it's easier, and I don't have to actually obey. I don't actually have to fulfill that commitment or be that responsible. I can only be responsible a little bit, just enough, and so I have that. Well, obviously, I think if we really give thought to it, we immediately see, and that's why I use the word tension, because our conscience is also there at the same time where we're kind of struggling with this, but our conscience perhaps is saying, now you know better than that. that's not the way, it should not be that way. I shouldn't be committed or loyal simply because I have to for a selfish reason. There ought to be more to this than that. There ought to be more to my marriage than that. There ought to be more to my relationships, even my job. There ought to be more to it than that. And now you apply all of this over to our relationship with God. Well, there you really begin to have that tension that now exists between maybe a sense of, well, I guess I have to do that, because I don't want God to be upset with me. And so there's an obedience, but can it not sometimes be forced. As we grow up from being a child and into adult, again, ideally, that is something that evolves, that is something that becomes different as we get older, as we mature. We begin to see, no, I shouldn't just obey mom and dad because, well, I don't want to get a spanking. There ought to be more to it than that. There ought to be, a sense of obligation that goes beyond just, well, I want to avoid consequences. You know, I don't want to lose, maybe mom and dad's let me do something, and so, well, I'll do the chores that they say I've got to do because I don't want to lose, you know, my privilege. I don't want to lose what they are allowing me to do, or I don't want to get in trouble. And then that then goes into other aspects of life, our first job, our marriage, our new family that we have, and you end up having a really unfortunate cycle if we don't grow up. If we don't mature, if we don't begin to see, hopefully sooner rather than later, although let's be honest, some of us maybe don't really get to this point until we are much older and we have squandered maybe many years of just frustrating ourselves with this forced obedience, these forced relationships, and have never been any sort of happy or satisfied or successful in anything that we've done because we've not really progressed beyond, well, I've got to. And of course, on that front, I call that being obedient, but you do so grudgingly. I only do it because I feel cornered. I feel like I'm boxed into that. So that's why I'm going to go ahead and fulfill responsibilities or obligations or commitments. I obey, well, because I have to. I'm being forced to. And so there is a sense of lifelong stress and lifelong frustration with that. And perhaps we eventually say, you know what, just forget it. That's not really important to me anymore anyway, so I'm not going to fulfill that responsibility anymore. And so you then have the tragic consequences that occur in all aspects of life, whether it's something maybe as trivial as quitting your job, or something far more serious, getting a divorce, or more serious yet, you know what? I'm not even going to bother with God anymore. I'm not going to do it. It's not worth it to me anymore. And that's tragic, and that's unfortunate. And so I hope this morning to address this from a perspective to where we don't get there. That instead we look at this early on. We look at this at whatever stage of life that you are right now, whether you're a young person or whether you're my age or older, where you're looking at this and you're giving consideration of what really is the proper motivation. And the word that we use, and it's one of these words that, you know, sometimes I'll bring up words that maybe are religious words that, you know, people use religiously, but they don't really know what they mean. You know those words, right? But then there are other words that are not necessarily religious, but they still have kind of grown out of use. And one of those words is being an earnest person. I joked one time, I don't know that he got it because of maybe the slight communication problem, but I joked with Ernest Roberts about that. I said, oh, well, you're an earnest person. I'm not sure he understood the joke with his name, but the idea of being earnest, earnestness, having that as a quality of character, is this idea that what you're doing is not just because you're forced to do it, but it's a desire. It's a commitment, again, not forced, but one taken on freely, but with great sense of obligation and commitment that is not derived from the outside. As they might say, it's not because there's a gun pointed at your head, but instead it is something that your soul drives you to that commitment and that responsibility. And that's the type of obedience and that's the type of commitment and loyalty that we seek to get you to think about this morning and to have that as being really why you do what you do. And if someone says you need to do it and you decide to do it, you're doing it because you're earnest and not because you're forced. Because you feel some sort of pressure to do that. We often talk about, especially in terms of younger people, although older people have it too, well, I've got peer pressure. Well, peer pressure doesn't end when you turn 18. Peer pressure continues on for the rest of your life, but that's not being earnest. An earnest person, without regard to any pressure to do something or not do something or to be different than what you are, your earnestness keeps you straightforward. And your obedience is something that then becomes a within thing and not a without thing from the outside. I want to look at a couple or a context that we don't normally look at from the standpoint, and we should, and unfortunately we don't, from the standpoint of not the application, which is what we typically focus on, but instead the principle behind the application. If you would, turn to 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. And I want to look at this passage, this context. And again, the application is important, and that's what we typically look at. And the context of what is being applied here is the idea that there are churches, there are Christians that need help, and there's a congregations that are in a position to help, and Paul is encouraging them to do so. And so we focus on that application of, well, you know, you have there's a need that is here, and we're encourage each other to take on the obligation and the commitment to provide those funds and those needs to do that, as the churches in Macedonia did, and as the church in Corinth was being asked to do. In fact, they had promised they would do it, and now Paul's reminding them of that promise and that pledge that they had made. And we focus on that, and rightly so. But there's an underlying principle that Paul develops here in writing to the Corinthians that a lot of times we overlook. We don't really see what that principle actually is. And so again, just to give you a sense of the context, we will start at the first verse. It says, "Now, brethren, we wish to make known to you the grace of God which has been given in the churches of Macedonia, that in a great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty overflowed in the wealth of their liberality." We're introduced here to a group of congregations in a region known as Macedonia, but what is most important about this group of churches is that despite their deep poverty, as it talks about here, and the affliction that they were suffering, and we can look at the history of that, and we learn when we do so that, you know, they had, you know, suffered a persecution from the Jews, but they also were not well off physically or financially speaking. Yet despite that, as it says at the end of verse 2, they overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. So here we have a group of people that did something very liberal in regards to their funds, the things they had. They didn't have much. It reminds us of the parable, of course, that Jesus spoke of the widow who, you know, she just had a very small amount of money. You know, sometimes translated like a couple pennies. But she gave it all. She's like, here, this is needed by someone else more than me, and she gave it. And that's the churches of Macedonia. He goes on to say, "I testify that according to their ability, yea, beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord, begging us with much urging for the favor of participation in the support of the saints." In other words, no one asked them to participate in this context of benevolence here. It was like, well, we don't expect you, you know, to participate in helping the, as we'll learn here as we go on in the text, the brethren in Jerusalem. We don't expect you. Your ability is limited. They begged, "We want to participate in this. Yes, we are in poverty ourselves, but that doesn't matter. We want to help." Now, that's the application. That's noble. You know, we could lift that up as a great example, and we often do. We even to this day, the churches of Macedonia have this reputation that has long outlived them. They have long been gone. And yet we know about this great desire of this group of Christians to help, even though they were not asked to, even though they were not expected to. But they beg to be able to be a part of this benevolent assistance. Why? Because that's the important question. Why? Well, clearly, it's not because Paul came by and said, all right, this is a command. You must obey. And then they said, oh, we don't really have any. But okay, if we have to. That's not the context at all. What was it? He goes on to say, verse 5, and this not as we had expected. Again, what was the expectation? You don't need to. Nobody expects you to assist. Not as we expected, but they first, now here's why. They first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. There was something within them that they gave over first. Before they gave one dime, or maybe I should say one drachma, before they gave one drachma, they gave themselves. I'm going to quote more fully a little later, but a famous writer, some of you are very familiar with him and are a fan, C.S. Lewis, he makes a point at one place in one of his writings about reminding us that Christ asked for everything, but that everything wasn't all our money. It wasn't everything we own. It was just us. He asked us for us. And that's what these brethren did. They gave themselves first. And later, he's going to call this earnestness. We'll get to that in a moment. That's what being earnest is. We give ourselves first. And he goes on to say in verse 6, and so we urge Titus that as he had previously made a beginning, or as he had previously made a beginning, so he would also complete in you this gracious work at well. So they're going to fulfill this sense of obligation now among the Corinthian brethren with this great example the Macedonians laid before them. And so Titus is being sent to Corinth to have them participate. He goes on to say, I am not, verse 7, but just as you abound in everything, in faith and utterance and knowledge and in all earnestness and in the love we inspired in you, see to it that you abound in this gracious work also. What's involved in being an earnest person in regard to your sense of obligation? Not a sense of obligation that you have been forced into, but a sense of obligation that you've willingly given yourself to. Because that's what they've done here. What is the foundation of that? Well, he lists them there in verse 7, if you notice closely. Faith, that's your trust. You're not going to be earnest in something or in someone. You're not going to give yourself to them if you don't trust them. Now, that has a wide variety of applications. Who you marry, your children, people you have relationships with, God. You give yourself to them because you trust them. That's why when trust is broken, it's a serious thing. It's not easily fixed. It's horrendously difficult to overcome the breaking of trust. But trust is at the foundation. We trust in God. We then give ourselves to God, and then we earnestly obey. We fulfill our responsibilities. We fulfill our obligations. We obey the commands. We do what God asks of us. Not because we're forced to. We have free will. We are not forced to obey God. We choose to do so because we give ourselves to Him. Because we trust in Him. He goes on to say, and utterance and knowledge. Utterance is what we say. Now again, I realize that words can be empty. Don't misunderstand. But again, these are not utterances or words that are insincere, but they are based on that trust. We talked about this when we talked about confession a month or so ago. The idea of really trusting, and that produces a commitment that is not just in the mind. It's like, well, I'm committed to this, but I'm not going to tell anybody, you know. Now, why would we do that? Well, that way, if I change my mind, you know, I'm not committed, right? They don't really know that I was committed to this, so, well, I'm sorry. A silent commitment is not a commitment. If you're committed to it, you will say so. That's one reason why we ask, do you believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God? We ask for that confession. Because if it's stated, it might still be fake. But if it's not stated, it's not real. If you don't confess the Lord in your heart, you're not going to confess Him with your mouth. And if you confess Him with your mouth, you at least are saying that you are committed. Now again, what's really in your heart, that's something that's a reality that you are dealing with between you and God. It's no different than a marriage. You ever been to a wedding ceremony and there's no vows made? You might say, well, that's kind of weird. I'd say there's a problem. No commitment verbalized? Really? Is there really a commitment here? They don't say, I will be faithful. I will love you. I will be with you for the rest of my life. Now again, we know many people have made vows and made commitments and they don't last. That's a problem. But there has to be that utterance. There has to be that speech. And notice it's based on knowledge. Oh, I didn't know what I was getting into. Is that not why some, when they are faced with responsibility, when they're faced with rules, when they're faced with laws, when they're faced with commitments, with responsibilities, they say, whoa, wait a minute. No one told me about that. You cannot be a Christian if you don't know. You cannot give yourself to God if you don't know. So yes, knowledge is absolutely a part of that. That's why we teach. That's why we study what God says. Because there has to be a knowledge that is there. There has to be that so that we can trust and we can make that good confession and then we can be earnest about it. We really have given ourselves to it. It's not hypocritical. It's not fake. It's not pretend. You know, I smile when I see children play church. But it disgusts me when I see adults play church. Now, if you don't get what I mean by that, I just simply challenge you to give more thought to what we're talking about. Because that goes from an immature mimicking of what is seen to, on the basis of knowledge now that I know, I have given myself to that and I'm not pretending and playing anymore. It's real. I obey from the heart. I obey because it's truly who I am. That's what the Macedonians were all about. That's why they begged to participate. They begged to do it. They wanted to do that. It's unfortunate when people, again, may make a false claim of obedience, and the first time something pops up that makes it convenient to get out of it, there they go. We all know that in life in general, we know people who are always looking for what? The easy out. I got myself into this. Oh, there's a way out. Whew. How many Christians do that? You think about that. This is what we're talking about when we're talking about being an earnest person and obeying from a perspective of being earnest. He goes on to say, verse 8, I am not speaking this as a command, but as proving through the earnestness of others the sincerity of your love also. This is actually the verse where I got the idea of calling this earnestness, is verse 8 here. It's what we're talking about. Notice that it is not a matter of, again, that he's commanding them to do it in a sense that you must do that, you're obligated to do it, but rather it's a proving of the earnestness. Proving what? That last phrase, the sincerity of your love also. See, the Macedonians are presented as a great example to the Corinthian people, but really what's on trial here, if you will, is not what the Macedonians have already done, but it's what the Corinthians are going to do. And as we see, it's on the basis of their pledge. They promised to do that in this context. So now, was that for real? Was that sincere? Or was it just words? I'm amazed at how many times I'm having conversation with my wife or someone else, and we'll say, well, they just like to talk. Well, what do we mean by that when we make that comment? You know what I mean. Those utterances up above are not actually based on trust and knowledge, but it is just talk. It's idle. It's like people like to say, oh, yeah, I'm there if you ever need me. I'm going to be engaged in that. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. They talk, but isn't sincere. And unfortunately, a lot of times it may even be the words, I love you. Is that just words? Or is that sincere? And what proves that? Well, your earnest fulfillment of the obligation, of the responsibility that comes with that love, that's what proves, as using his words here, proving through the earnestness of others the sincerity of your love also. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ. Now here's the ultimate example. Verse 9. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich. The Macedonian poverty and their giving of themselves beyond their ability in that poverty is a great example, but the greatest example of that is Jesus Christ. That in his abject poverty of suffering on the cross, he gave the great riches of salvation. And that is the ultimate example. You want to know, well, how can I be motivated to really be a sincere, earnest person to where I'm obeying because that's who I am rather than being forced to? We merely look at the cross, and that is one reason we partake of the Lord's Supper and do so regularly. We continue in that, weekly partaking of that, to remember that sacrifice. And one thing we're remembering is the earnestness of Jesus, and that is a motivation for ours as well. So he says to them, verse 10, I give my opinion in this manner, for this is to your advantage, who were the first to begin a year ago not only to do this, but also to desire to do it. You started this. Are you going to finish it? He says, but now finish it, verse 11. So that just as there was a readiness or desire to do it, so there may also now be a completion of it by your ability. Now again, I know the application here. The application made here is to their participating in this giving to the needy saints in Jerusalem. But the principle we can apply to everything. And the principle is what I want us to focus on. The principle of Jesus Christ of being earnest in our obedience on the basis of our sincere readiness that then is produced in obedience, produced in following through with it or to finish it. I ask you this morning, will you finish it? If you desire to be a part of God, will you finish that? Finish it is what Paul says here. That is what the earnest person does. And so as we, you know, you can read the rest of the context on your own, but I do want to jump ahead a little bit to chapter 9 and notice a couple of things here. He says in verse 2, I know your readiness, of which I boast about you to the Macedonians, namely that Achaia has been prepared since last year, and your zeal has stirred up most of them. But I have sent the brethren in order that our boasting about you may not be made empty. What that emphasizes is that it's still their choice. Despite their zeal and despite their desire to do it, it can still be walked away from. I know some say, well, you know, it's just a matter of, you know, God picking you or whatever, and that you really have no choice in the matter. You always have a choice. Even if you've become a Christian, you have a choice. And again, the principle that is there. And he ends up, this leads into, I want to read verses 5 and 6 of chapter 9. So I thought it necessary to urge the brethren that they would go on ahead to you and arrange beforehand your previously promised bountiful gift, so that the same would be ready as a bountiful gift and not be affected by covetousness. So now we're ready to talk about, we talked about the strengths of all of this. We talked about that's how you're earnest and why you're earnest, why you go through this and you obey, not because you're forced to, but because that's who you are. What's the threat? What's the weakness that is ever present? I would say the choice is the strength, but the weakness side of it is covetousness. A beginning to look at other things and say, well, you know what? I think I've changed my mind. I'm in love with this now. Selfishness, ambition, greed. And covetousness isn't necessarily a parallel word to those other things, but it's a part of it. You can be covetousness or be covetous and not have a thing. But you're not satisfied and you desire it. You desire more. You desire something different. It's never enough. And that's a danger to Christians. Even if we make a promise to God, if we don't fully give ourselves to God, that giving or making a commitment to God can easily be replaced with something else that attracts us, that tempts us. And that's why covetousness in the New Testament is called idolatry. The idols of our life that we allow to replace God. And so beware of that. And he says, I don't want you to be affected by covetousness. And then he says this in verse 6. Now this I say, he who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, but he who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Now what does he mean by that verse in this context? Well, you could interpret verse 6, and it often is, in the context of, well, their gift. So, you know, you give a little, you'll reap a lot. But I want to suggest that maybe really what he's talking about here in verse 6 is not the dollar amount or the drachma amount that they're going to give, but rather the giving of themselves, the amount of that. You sow sparingly, you reap sparingly. How would that maybe play out? Oh yeah, we'll participate. And then it's like, it becomes like, well, as little as possible. You know, so that we are listed on the list of, as the participants in this. You know, we got our name on the list, so yeah, that's enough. You sow sparingly, you reap sparingly. You don't give yourself, then you're going to reap accordingly. And so the principle of reaping or sowing and harvesting, sowing and reaping, is not just applied in monetary amounts. Forget that. Set that aside. It applies to how much of your heart, how much of your soul, how much of your mind, how much of your trust that you have. How much are you really going to give to the Lord? How many people say, oh, I give to the Lord. They may even say, I gave myself to the Lord. And then you bring out the chart that says, well, yeah, that much. You see, remember those charts? I hate those charts, by the way. Where you take your life and you divide it up, and in one of the slices is God's. Have you seen those charts? Preachers used to use them all the time. Absolutely hate them. Because it violates this very principle. The whole thing is God's. If you give yourself to God, it's all God's. And everything you do in your life is to the Lord. Not just 3 hours. All of it. That is being earnest. That is obeying out of earnestness. It is all yours to give or not. And you give it or not. And that is the principle. I want to begin concluding with another passage, going back to Jesus' words. If you would turn with me to Matthew chapter 10. And I mainly just want to read this. I don't really have a lot of additional comment to make, but I do think this relates to the principle that Paul is referencing here. Matthew chapter 10, and I'm going to begin reading at verse 24, and I'm just going to read to the end of the chapter. Now, I think these words speak very clearly, but I want you to listen clearly so that you can really give full analysis in your own mind of how earnest are you. Are you really sincere in your discipleship? Jesus says, starting in verse 24, a disciple is not above his teacher, nor slave above his master. It is enough for the disciple that he be become like his teacher and the slave like his master. If they have called the head of the house Beelzebub, they had just referenced Jesus as following Beelzebub, or devil, the Satan, false god, how much more will they malign the members of the house of his household? Therefore, do not fear them. For there is nothing concealed that will not be revealed, or hidden that will not be known. What I tell you in the darkness, speak in the light. And what you hear whispered in your ear, proclaim upon the housetops. There's that utterances that Paul referenced. Do not fear those who kill the body but are unable to kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a cent, and yet not one of them will fall on the ground apart from your Father? But the very hairs of your head are all numbered, so don't fear. You are more valuable than many sparrows. Therefore, everyone who confesses me before men, I will also confess him before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I will also deny him before my Father who is in heaven. Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I came to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's enemies will be the members of his household. And here's the point of that, verse 37. He who loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take his cross, this is what we referenced earlier, he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who has found his life will lose it, and he who has lost his life for my sake will find it. He who receives you receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me. He who receives a prophet in the name of a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward. And he who receives a righteous man in the name of a righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward. And whoever in the name of a disciple gives to one of these little ones even a cup of cold water to drink, truly I say to you, he shall not lose his reward. Here we see the depiction of Jesus of a true disciple of his, one who is earnest in his obedience, and also recognizes priorities. We haven't talked as much about that in this lesson, but that sounds forth very loudly in this text. Paul says to the Romans in Romans chapter 12 and verse 1 that our lives are to be a living sacrifice. And again, it's based on the principle, well, what's the sacrifice? We know in the Old Testament sacrifices, the sacrifices were to be their best, the unblemished. If our life's a living sacrifice, what are we giving? Just a few hours? Just the leftovers? Just of what? Well, I've done everything else. Well, okay, God, I got a little bit here for you. No, we give it all. We give ourselves. We give our very selves. That's why in Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20, it says that we are indeed, as Jesus referenced here in Matthew 10, we are crucified with Christ. We put ourselves up right up there beside him. And we do so not because we're forced to, but because we are earnest. That's who we are. We give ourselves to him. And so you say, wow, that's hard. That's hard. And yet Jesus says that, and if you notice the very next chapter, if you're still in Matthew chapter 11, in verse 25 and following, it says, I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and intelligent and have revealed them to infants. Yes, Father, for this way was well-pleasing in your sight. All things have been handed over to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, nor does anyone know the Father except the Son, and anyone whom the Son wills to reveal him. Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. 10 verse 38 talks about a cross. 11 verse 30 talks about a yoke, but a yoke that is easy and light. Now what's going on here, Jesus? It's the same dilemma that we have in, am I going to obey or not? Am I going to be responsible or not? Am I going to be committed or not? Am I going to fulfill that obligation or not? It's the same tension. One is based on the fact that, yes, it's all. It's not part. It's sincere. It's true. It's real. From that perspective, yes, it's a cross. It's difficult. But from the other perspective, if you give yourself, it suddenly becomes very easy. Because it's not by force anymore. It's not because you have to and you feel pressured to. Instead, it is liberatingly given freely. It's just there. It's a part of you. It's who you are. And so from that perspective, as John says in 1 John chapter 5 and verse 3, the Lord's commandments are not burdensome. Remember that little statement we read in 2 Corinthians? Paul said it's to your advantage. Did you catch that? I didn't focus on that immediately. I want you to think about that now. It's to your advantage to truly enter into the commitment and to do so sincerely with all your heart and to obey out of earnestness. And this gets back to my quote as we conclude. C.S. Lewis said, he said, yes, Jesus Christ says, give me all. But then he says, I don't want so much of your time. I don't want so much of your money. I don't want so much of your work. He then says, Jesus says, I want you. I have not come to torment your natural self, but I've come to kill it. No half measures are any good. This gets to the passages, and we don't have time to look into them, but you can. You know them. You crucify what? What's on that cross? It's that old man. It's that old man of selfishness. It's that old man of ambition and conceit. It's that old man that is forced, that feels constantly conflicted and compelled, and yet doesn't really want to do it. And so he never really does. That's the man and the woman, that old man and woman that's on the cross. But now, it's on the cross to be killed, to be done away with, and replaced in a resurrection, in a new life, a new man and a new woman that is now ready to obey because they have truly given everything. And thus it becomes easy. If you're half-hearted about something, let's say it's your job, just to use that as one application and illustration, and you're just half-hearted in the job, it's not really what you want to do. You feel obligated to do certain things. And the boss comes in and says, okay, here's your next assignment. And you go, oh. Why is that so difficult? It's part of your job. Did you expect it to be something that you really wanted to do on another level? What makes it so hard is not the assignment itself. I'm here to tell you, what makes that difficult and hard is that it's half-hearted. That's not really what you want to do. You haven't given yourself. Now, apply that more importantly to God. Jesus comes in and says, this is what I want you to do. And on the inside you go, why is it so hard? Why is it so hard to avoid sin, stay away from evil, to do what is right? Because you're half-hearted in it. You haven't given yourself. So as we sing a song, Michael, what song have you picked out this morning? Number 97, blue hymnals. Perfect song. Prince of Peace, control my will. You give yourself to him. I want you to think about it as we sing this song and the other songs that Michael will lead, and as we partake of the Lord's Supper, during all of this, to think about your commitment. And I want you to ask yourself the question, first of all, am I going to be committed? If you've not committed yourself to the Lord, you think about that. And if you have committed yourself to the Lord, now are you earnest about it? Have you given yourself? If you give yourself first, you'll be begging to participate in discipleship like the Macedonians. You'll want to do things that you're not even able to do because that's just who you are. You've given yourself to God. You think about this. If we can help you in any way, pray with you, hear your confession, baptize you, whatever it may be, we ask that you come and let us know while we sing this song. Let's stand.